So one of the things we're going to be looking at tonight, this picture that I have, not really a picture, an artist conception. And I think it's interesting that of all of the kings that we looked at in Jeremiah, we're going to be focused on one particular king that we just don't know a whole lot about, Jehoiachin. He was the only king who was willing to submit himself to Babylonian rule. And as was promised, Jehoiachin lived and lived the rest of his life taken care of by the Lord because he submitted himself to the Babylonians. Now, that's not to say that life was hunky-dory for him when he did that. He spent many, many years in jail, in prison. But he will live much of the rest of his life at a higher station than most of the Israelites who were in Babylon because he submitted to what he was supposed to do, and that is surrender to the Babylonians. We'll get into that in a little bit. So when we start into chapter 52 and we're looking at the reign of Zedekiah, we see that we're right in the middle of the capture of Jerusalem. And so why did this happen in Judah and Jerusalem?
He did evil in the sight of the Lord.
Yeah, because Zedekiah aroused the anger of the Lord by doing evil in the sight of him, like all that Jehoiakim had done. And so if we look at verse 2, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, like all that his... I can't even remember the relationship.
Jehoiakim.
Yeah, is this his brother or is this his father?
No.
He was the uncle to one of them, so I think it was his brother. I think Jehoiakim was his brother.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, they were sons of Josiah. So, yeah, Zedekiah chose to do evil just like his brother Jehoiakim had done. And because of that, he was, he's going to pay the price. He's going to pay a dear price for his evil. So where was Zedekiah overtaken and captured?
In the plains of Jericho.
Right, in the plains of Jericho. His army was scattered from him. And if you remember, he and his, whatever army he had slunk out of Egypt by way of the king's garden, the gate of the king's garden. And in verse 7, it tells the city was broken into. All the men of war fled and went forth from the city by night by way of the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were all around the city. And they went by way of the Arabah, which is the desert south of Jerusalem. So they thought they were going to just sneak away. But in verse 8, the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered from him. And then Zedekiah was captured, and the king brought, they captured the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah in the hand of Hamath, and he, that is the king of Babylon, that is Nebuchadnezzar, passed sentence on him. And so what did this cost Zedekiah? What was this sentence?
Well, they killed all of his sons and then put his eyes out.
Yeah. So he watched his family die before his eyes, watched his children. In verse 10, the king of Babylon slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. And he also slaughtered all the princes of Judah at Riblah, in Riblah. And then in verse 11, then he blinded the eyes of Zedekiah. So the last thing Zedekiah saw was his children or his sons being slaughtered. And then his eyes were put out. And then the king of Babylon bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon and put him in prison until the day of his death. And this was the punishment Zedekiah earned for ignoring the Lord. And as we read the first time we studied this, several lessons ago, Zedekiah had received from Jeremiah had received word that if he would just surrender, the Lord would be gracious. If he would just do what the Lord commanded, this wouldn't have befallen him. But he was afraid of what the Jews would think of him. He was afraid of what the royals would think if he surrendered to the Babylonians. He was afraid of them. He thought that they would kill him when he was taken prisoner. When he got to Babylon, he thought for sure that the Jews would kill him instead of being killed by the Babylonians because he had surrendered to the enemy. Jeremiah told him that was something he did not need to fear, that that was something he didn't have to worry about, that that would not happen. But he was unwilling to listen. And because of that, Zedekiah paid the price by losing his family, losing his eyes, and then losing his life.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that, Nebuchadnezzar's got a little irritated at Zedekiah because it took him a year and a half to break through the walls of the city, Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So that cost Nebuchadnezzar a little bit as far as time and resources and that type of thing. So no wonder he was mad.
Absolutely. He had, and not only that, Zedekiah, again, in the family of the line of the kings, was the man chosen by Nebuchadnezzar to be put in charge of Israel. So Nebuchadnezzar thought he had done Zedekiah a great service. He had given him kingship. A kingship he would never have inherited. As an uncle to the line of succession, he was never going to be one of the chosen ones to have the throne. That would always fall in the direct line of succession from Josiah to his sons to their sons. So when Zedekiah was given the throne, Nebuchadnezzar had done Zedekiah a great service in doing so. And Zedekiah just absolutely ignored that and betrayed Nebuchadnezzar, went against him, and then forced Nebuchadnezzar to come and take the city. And Nebuchadnezzar, because he spent 18 months breaking down that wall, well, we know what's going to happen. He's not just going to break down that wall again. He's going to completely destroy the city. His men completely dismantled the walls of Jerusalem. And not only that, they burned the temple. Absolute destruction is all that's left of Jerusalem once Nebuchadnezzar is done. And the line of succession of kings, gone.
Ted?
Yeah, Dean.
What I have read about this is that when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, he was basically financing this incursion into Jerusalem that he had to undertake because of Zedekiah's revolt. So he took everything that had any value in the temple basically to pay his army.
Yeah, absolutely. This was not a war that Nebuchadnezzar thought he was going to have to fight. He had specifically put Zedekiah in power to have a puppet king that he would control, that would give him power and authority over those areas. And we even saw that after Zedekiah was gone, and Nebuchadnezzar put another man in charge. Again, somebody that he thought he could trust. But that man was arrogant and stubborn and lost his life because he did not listen to those who were giving him good advice. And that wound up costing lives of Jews, lives of Chaldeans, lives of the men, all of the people who this ruler who had been put over in charge by Nebuchadnezzar. Once he was killed, then it cost many, many lives because of that. So we see that. Again, what we have here is the Lord having told Judah and Jerusalem to surrender to the Babylonians. And if they would surrender, the Lord would take care of them. The Lord would make sure they were taken care of. But again, we have time after time that the people ignore the word of the Lord. Time after time, they pay the price for it. So, yeah, go ahead, Richard.
One thing I wanted to point out about Zedekiah is today, you know, we can think about our actions and we can see and we can try and change some things. He could have changed, but he didn't. So as Ron pointed out, you know, he had to watch his family being taken care of. And then when he had his eyes put out, I'm not sure how long he lived after that. But in just thinking, his thoughts then were of the what he, hopefully his thoughts would be, all the stuff that he had did wrong and what it cost him. And today we're, you know, we have that same opportunity to make changes, but a lot of people don't make those changes. And they too, at some point in time, will not see anything but darkness. So that I just wanted to point that out.
Sure. And one other thing we can point out is Zedekiah had the bat phone or the red phone or whatever you want to call it, direct line to God through Jeremiah. He was getting God's word as Jeremiah had it revealed to him from God. There's no excuse for Zedekiah making the choices he did when he was getting the answer that he was looking for, but he just didn't like the answer. We sometimes have to make decisions based on what we read in the scripture, what we know to be right by what we've been told by the Lord. But Zedekiah was getting it straight from the horse's mouth. Jeremiah was asking Jeremiah questions. Jeremiah was coming back to Zedekiah with answers straight from the Lord. And Zedekiah was then saying, I don't like that answer. Seems silly to me. Absolutely silly.
Well, but it's not always what we want. It's what God's going to give us. And like you said, that was said very plain. If you just do this, you know, and he just chose the other direction.
And that's exactly what happens today, because God has been very plain in his message today as well. I don't think there's any ambiguity in what God requests from us and how we live our lives. I think God has been very, very open, very honest, and has pointed out what he expects from us to live our lives righteously today. But again, people choose to go a different direction. That's a choice. One thing that God did give us is free will. And you have the choice. You have the choice to choose not what God wants, but there is a price to pay. And so I think we can take from this lesson the fact that you do have free will. You can make that choice, but there's going to be a price to pay. And so we're going to look at part of that price next. So who was carried away into Babylon?
Some of the poorest people and the rest of the people left in the city.
Yeah. Yeah, the rest were left in the city, but some of the poorest, there wasn't much left of Jerusalem. And we're going to look at those numbers here in just a minute, because this chapter actually lets us know how many people were actually carried away. But some of the poorest people are all that's left in Jerusalem now. We don't really have a whole lot of rulers left. And the ones that were left, most of them got killed because they had betrayed Babylon. They had betrayed the king who left them in charge. and only a very few handful were actually even carried away in captivity. The rest of them were killed. And we'll see that in just a minute, too. So the other part of this is the city is burned. Captives are taken away. The walls are destroyed. And then what happens to the temple? Well, it's destroyed and plundered. So how were the pillars of the temple described that the king of Babylon took? I'll get this one started for you because I kind of summed it up for you. Instead of using that cubit measurement, I converted that all for you so you can understand what it looks like. So these pillars were 27 feet tall with an 18-foot circumference. And the bronze on them, they were hollow pillars. The bronze was 4 inches thick. The capital on top of the pillars were 8 feet tall with a network of bronze pomegranates all around the capital. Very ornate, very beautiful, costly workmanship. And you cannot imagine how much these bronze pillars would weigh. Think about this. We're talking about pillars that were an 18-foot circumference, that were 20 or 35 feet tall, including the Capitol. That's gigantic. That's taller than most of the houses we live in. And the bronze was 4 inches thick. These aren't small pieces of bronze that he took. And there were several of these pillars. But as Dean pointed out, he had to finance this 18-month assault. So these bronze pillars are going to pay part of that price, plus whatever other unplundered temple parts and pieces were left, those left with them as well. And then what was left of the temple was destroyed, was burned. There was nothing left. This all happened because Zedekiah and the kings before him of the line of Josiah would not listen to what God said, would not surrender to Babylon. Could have saved Jerusalem, could have saved the temple. But because they would not listen to God, because they stood up to the king, it was all destroyed. Everything. Everything that Solomon had built was gone. Because it wasn't just the temple, and it wasn't just the walls. They destroyed all of the royalty palaces, all of the housing, all of that stuff was gone. They burned the city, destroyed everything. And if you look at verse 19, the captain of the guard also took away the bowls, the fire pans, the basins, the pots, the lampstands, the pans, the drink offering bowls, what was fine gold and what was fine silver. The two pillars, the one sea, the 12 bronze bulls that were under the sea, and the stands which King Solomon had made for the house of the Lord, the bronze of all these vessels was beyond weight. Had to finance this 18-month destruction of the city.
Kid,
and then, yeah, go ahead, Dean.
I find it really interesting that these things were still intact and apparently would have been preserved. They apparently would not have been destroyed. I really like the emphasis that you placed on this rebellion against God winds up costing them the most precious thing that they owned.
Yeah, absolutely. And, verse 21 through 20, let me back up here. Verse 21 through 23 tell you just how ornate some of these things were. The goes into great detail about these pillars. But the most important thing to learn from this is that because Zedekiah was so stubborn, because Zedekiah was unwilling to listen to the many times that Jeremiah had told him over his 11-year reign of Jerusalem. Jeremiah told Zedekiah again and again, just listen to the Lord. Just do what the Lord says and you will be fine. He has promised he will take care of you. Just don't fight Babylon. Babylon is the Lord's servant, who the Lord is exacting vengeance on not only Judah and Jerusalem, but all the nations. And we went into great detail about that a couple of weeks ago, about how Babylon was going to completely and utterly annihilate some nations, and they would no longer exist. And how other nations, they would be taken into captivity and would return from captivity when Israel returned from captivity. But because Zedekiah was so hard-hearted, so stubborn, he cost Israel all of these things. So, getting into verse 24, the leaders of Jerusalem are taken and executed. So, who did the captain of the guard take to Riblah and execute?
He took the chief priest and Zephaniah and the keeper of the door.
Yep, he took three officers of the temple, the overseer of the men of war, seven of the king's advisors, the scribe of the commander of the army, and 60 men of the people of the land who were in the city. He took them to Riblah, and they were all executed. Zedekiah's hard-heartedness cost all these people their lives. Didn't have to happen. But they were all executed by the king of Babylon. And again, you can understand why. Nebuchadnezzar was required to come down to Jerusalem a third time because the person he had put in charge had betrayed him. So he took his vengeance. He took his vengeance on all of these people. They all paid the price for Zedekiah not submitting. So we also are going to get into an account of all the people that were taken. So how many people were carried away by Nebuchadnezzar to captivity?
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds.
For sure.
4,600.
4,600.
Yeah. I think I heard the number. Total of 4,600 persons altogether. And if we look at that, and it's broken down for us in verses 28, 29, and 30. In verse 28, this was in the seventh year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. He took 3,023 Jews. In verse 29, in the 18th year of his reign, he took 832 persons. And in the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away into exile 745 Jewish people. So a total of 4,600 persons in all. How many people were living in Judah and Jerusalem at that time? I can tell you it was a lot, whole lot more than 4,600 persons. All of those people died, except for the handfuls of the poorest of the poor who were left to fend for themselves in the now completely broken-walled city that was undefendable, that could be ravaged by any nation around them that still had power, that Babylon hadn't completely and utterly destroyed, by any roving nomads who wanted to settle there. But look at that. 4,600 persons were carried away. You would think of all of the thousands and thousands or even millions of Jews who lived in the land that there would be many more people carried away into captivity. But what this tells us is that Nebuchadnezzar, you know, he wanted some slaves, but he was not afraid at all of just wiping people out. And that's precisely what he did. Because if you didn't go into captivity and you weren't the poorest of the poor, then as God had told us throughout Jeremiah, there was going to be plenty of bodies to feed the wild animals because they were going to litter the ground literally. And that's precisely what happened. And this gives us a number. This puts a firm number on who went away into captivity and who didn't. And lets us know that it was a massacre. Because tens or even hundreds of thousands of people were killed by Nebuchadnezzar. And again, this could have all been avoided, as we read time and time again through Jeremiah, if the people would just have submitted to the Lord and surrender to Babylon.
Jeremiah came and he told them what the Lord's words were, and they never listened.
Time and time again he did that.
For
at least the 40 years that this book spans, he told them time and time again what they needed to do. And they were unwilling to listen. They had a good king in Josiah for 31 years who did his very best to turn this country around to bring them back to the Lord, and they were unwilling to listen. So 4,600 persons were all that were carried away into captivity. And most of them happened in the first wave. Just a couple of hundred in his 18th year, and even fewer in his 23rd year. Because he slaughtered the rest of them. And then finally, as we close out chapter 52, we hear a little bit more about Jehoiachin, or Kaniah, or Jeconiah. He goes by all of those names. This was the one king who walked out of Jerusalem and surrendered to Babylon. Surrendered to Nebuchadnezzar. He was taken away into captivity. He was put in prison. So when was Jehoiachin brought out of prison?
12th month, 5th and 20th day of month, 7 and 30th year.
So that's right. He spent 37 years in exile, in prison. And then finally, after Nebuchadnezzar died and evil Merodach became the king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign, evil Merodach showed favor to Jehoiachin, king of Judah, and brought him out of prison. Then he spoke kindly to him. He set his throne above the thrones of the kings who were with him in Babylon. And how was Jehoiachin treated by evil Merodach until his death?
Very good. At his reign, he lifted up the head of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and spoke kindly to him.
Exactly. He was a favorite of the kings until the day of his death. Kind words, kingly meals, a regular allowance, a daily portion set above the thrones of the kings who were with him in Babylon. Because Jehoiachin, or maybe it was because he was scared, I don't know if it was because he was obeying what the Lord had told him, but because Jehoiachin wound up doing what the Lord said to do, which was surrender to Babylon, Jehoiachin had a good life. He paid for it for a while in prison, but he lived out the rest of his days in splendor. He was taken care of by the Lord, as was promised. You can't say that about any of the other line of descendant of Josiah's children or his brother, because they all paid the price for their obstinance, for their ignorance, and for disobeying the Lord. And so another lesson we can learn from that is, yes, the Lord does want us to obey him. The Lord wants us to make that choice. And hopefully that's what Jehoiachin did. But sometimes even the unluckiest squirrel gets a nut. And it looks like if Jehoiachin was surrendering to the Lord, great. If he wasn't, he fell into obedience just by dumb luck or fear and surrendered to Babylon. And because of that, he was taken care of.
Kind of interesting, Ted, that in the archaeological digs 100 years or so ago, they dug up some clay tablets that recorded those very things that evil Merodach had done for Jehoiachin, that he provided a daily sustenance for him. That was recorded on clay tablets, which just bears out the proof of what had happened. Kind of interesting.
That's very interesting. Yeah, which gives even more credence to the fact that all of this stuff actually did happen. That Israel went into captivity and then was released again. Actually happened just like it was told us in the Bible. It's kind of funny that archaeologists and historians doing these kind of explorations go to the Bible to look for clues for where things can be. And that's, as I understand, who is the archaeologist that we know that has had...
Don Patton.
Don Patton pointed out more than once that the archaeologists who have done some of the digs, especially digs on the House of David and the Temple of Solomon, have definitely gone to the Bible looking for clues as to where to go. And it's because of their study, the close study of what the Bible recorded, that they were able to find things that just at the beginning of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, people were saying the Bible was wrong. It never really happened. There was no House of David. There was no Solomon's private house. Those things didn't exist until they found them. Then they did exist.
I found somewhere, I can't recall where it was, that evil Merodach, who treated Jehoiachin kindly, only reigned for 1 year.
Yeah, could be. I didn't look at the as I pointed out, I think it was last week, the lines of the kings in Babylon and in Persia especially. I think we looked at the Persian kings. That was a real mess. The line of succession for Nebuchadnezzar was something different. It was his grandson that finally paid the price and cost Babylon its country, because he was just absolutely a filthy partier who would not listen to the Lord at all and caused the fall of Babylon. But the line of succession, or at least the kingships in the Mede and Persian Empire, again, was just a weird mess and really funny how power came to be for the different kings in the Medes and the Persians. Wasn't always the strongest person. Sometimes it was the most witty person that took that kingship. So that concludes our study of Jeremiah. Just a few lessons and applications to look at. We'll start with this idea. The destruction of the temple, as described in this chapter, verses 12 through 14, while this was the house of God, we should not forget that it was not the physical structure that meant the most to him. What made this place sacred was his presence and what they did for God there. It was how the people worshiped God. It was their heart towards him that made the temple a special place. Not the fact that Solomon had built it. Because in Solomon's mind, that was important. And in David's mind, too, he wanted to build the temple as well. And the Lord forbade that, but gave that right and honor to Solomon. But the physical place is not as important to God as the heart. And it's important for us to remember that, you know, all of the gold and silver and bronze and the cedars of Lebanon and all of the expense that went into that temple, God didn't care anything about that. That wasn't important to God. What was important were the people's hearts. And as we saw time and time again, the people's hearts were far from him. And so God was absolutely willing to allow Jerusalem and his temple to be utterly, utterly annihilated, to show that even his people, if they are disobedient to him, will pay the price. That should put holy terror into the hearts of people who are absolutely unwilling to bow their knee to God. Because if God is willing to forsake his people, then God is willing to forsake all people who are not willing to worship him. So this is where we get into our discussion of the book of Jeremiah. So how would you summarize the message of the book of Jeremiah? And I don't think there's any one right answer. I'm not looking for any one right answer. I'm just looking for what you think would be a good way to summarize this book.
I wrote down, listen to God.
Absolutely. Especially when you're getting God's word spoken to you at that moment, at that time. I mean, it is always amazing to me that people can ignore the words of a prophet from God, even after that prophet has been shown to be a prophet. Jeremiah had prophesied certain things. And over his 40 years of prophecy, some of those things came true. Well, I won't say some of them. Anything that he had prophesied that happened within it, that 40 years happened. The people had no reason to find any fault in him, to distrust him in any way. He had been shown to be the prophet who he said he was. But still the people ignored him. And so my summary of the book of Jeremiah would be, hey, stupid, listen to what God says. Because he is giving you really good advice based on what he wants you to do. And we can take from the book of Jeremiah an application of how we should be warned about how important it is to listen to the things that God tells us in the new covenant. We shouldn't be picking and choosing those things that we want to obey and then throwing the rest away, because that is abhorrent to God, and he is unwilling to be lenient towards that attitude. He showed us this time and time again in Jeremiah to king after king who was unwilling to listen to God. And we saw the result for those kings. Any other ideas?
I just wrote down, God is in control all the time.
Absolutely. That's a great summary of this book. God is in control. And we read that several times, that God is in control and will always be in control of his creation. Remember that. He is the creator. Any other ideas?
John 3:16.
We had some reference to Christ throughout Jeremiah. Yep, we did. And that idea that Christ was going to come and be a propitiation, a mediator between us and God. Those ideas were starting to develop, and we were given some hints about that. That's a great point, Wes.
Okay, go now.
God means what he says.
He expects obedience, and we need to take him seriously.
Absolutely. I think that there's anything you can take from the book of Jeremiah, it's that God means what he says. And if you are unwilling to listen to God, then there will be a price to pay. We often see or hear it said that that price may be in this life or it may be in the next. And for those who disobey God and that price isn't until the next, I think that's probably a disservice for them. Because I would love for some of those people to have the chance to change their hearts and minds and make the choice to understand that God is in control. But if we don't listen to God, there will be a price to pay. And if we live long enough, it will most definitely be in this life. I've always said to my crew at work, stupidity should be painful, but it's not. Often it isn't. People make stupid choices all the time, and many times they don't pay the price. But we see in this instance, in this book, time and time again, that stupidity or obstinance should be painful, because that's the only way that humans seem to be able to learn is through pain. You would think that after example after example after example, over hundreds and hundreds of years, the Jews seeing what the result is of disobeying the Lord through the judges, through the kings, that they would understand that you cannot disobey the Lord and think it's going to be all hunky-dory. But Israel did not learn time after time after time. And so this was what the Lord had promised, the curses that would come from breaking the covenant. And we looked at those as well early in our study, those curses that were going to come upon the people if they broke the covenant. And those curses definitely came upon them. Any other ideas?
I think the thing that stands out for me to a great degree, not only in the book of Jeremiah, but as you said, through other books as well, Judges, Kings, is the long suffering that the Lord has. But there is an end to his patience. He puts up with sin long enough, and eventually the result is the terror that comes upon people. In our lifetime, his long suffering is up until the day of our death. He gives us an opportunity. But I see this book of Jeremiah and Judges that we went through. God just is patient, and his patience is just absolutely unbelievable.
Agreed. Agreed. His patience is unbelievable. Hundreds and hundreds of years of the people going back and forth, throwing God away and falling into idolatry, and then the Lord punishing them, them coming back to the Lord for a generation or less, and then falling back into idolatry. Unbelievable the patience the Lord had to wait this long to utterly punish the people. They had short-term punishments here and there, as we saw in the Judges. And there was punishment that came in various forms throughout that, but they always had their land. They always had the promised land. And they always had the temple once it was built. The tabernacle, the temple, the place that they could go. They were God's people. And this idea carried through even to the New Covenant, or even into the New Testament, I will say, into the time of Jesus, where the scribes and Pharisees described themselves as the blood of Abraham. You know, they had inherited that through Abraham. And we read time and time again in the New Testament how the righteous heart was much more precious to the Lord than being in a blood lineage of a man who the Lord had selected as one of his own.
Ken?
So, yeah, go ahead, Richard.
Well, mine's kind of a combination of your number two and number three. I look at the correlation between not only, as Ron was just saying, Jeremiah and the kings and everything, between it and your New Testament, and that you're going to get out of this life what you put into it spiritually, which was what, you know, they never understood. And as I told you this morning, I've been studying
Romans,
and they talk about, you know, salvation by faith. You know, Jesus told them, you know, I'm not here to get rid of the law, I'm here to fulfill it. And if they would have been listening at any time, all they had to do is just listen and do and have that faith, and they would have been on the right side of God instead of being totally, in some cases, totally annihilated, wiped out, even where they lived, because they didn't want to listen. And I see that today with people who, I don't know really exactly how to say this, and I don't want to upset anybody, but, you know, there we have people that all look at the Bible, and then they'll just go, yeah, well, I understand some, but, you know, I want to still go out and party and drink or have any excuses, you know. Then what they really need to do is to study and be saved, but they're so drawn up into this world. And that's the correlation with a lot of them back then. I was trying to think of the gentleman there that never killed. He had the chance, and a lot of them had the chance to do what was right, but they never chose that. They didn't even listen to people who were directly talking to God. They just decided to do what they wanted to do. And in a lot of cases, which was evil. So.
Yep, absolutely. And we saw we saw two points of view in Jeremiah. We saw the Lord say that these people would not be saved, that though Moses stood in front of him, or Elijah or Samuel were to stand in front of him, he would not save these people. But then we also saw later that the Lord said that, Lord told Jeremiah, if they will just submit to me, I will prevent the calamity from coming upon them. It's hard to jive those two different ideas. Lord saying there's no way that they're going to be saved, and then the Lord telling them there is a way to be saved. But what you forget, or I think one of the things we can look at is one of the first things we read here is that it's harder for the Ethiopian to change his skin color or the leopard to change his spots than for these people to change their heart. The Lord knew what choices they were going to make. The Lord knew the outcome. That's how the Lord can say, no one's going to change my mind, but then also give them the opportunity to make the choice. Because the Lord can see the outcome. He knows where this is going. He knows the hearts of these people. He knows the hearts of the kings that were in line of succession. He knew the choices they were going to make. But they were choices. They had the opportunity to change their destiny. and they chose not to do it. Time and time again.
Ted.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Just bringing up the subject of backsliders, there had to have been some in those days, right?
Sure.
Well, the Lord said he gave them the chance still, right? He said, come to me. They had backslidden, but he says, come to me and do what my will is, and you will be saved, right? Is that right or not?
Sure. The Lord gives us, and as Ron pointed out, his patience is so far above ours, it's just ridiculous. We don't understand how to be that patient. It is very difficult for us to be slapped in the face time and time and time again. And as even Jesus pointed out to the man who asked him, my brother lies to me or betrays me. How often should I forgive him? Seven times? And Jesus said, no, not seven times, 70 times seven. That idea that we need to be as forgiving as the Lord is. And he was very long-suffering with these people. Very patient. Gave them opportunity after opportunity to change their hearts and minds so that he could give them all of the blessings that he had promised them. But the Lord, being who he is, omniscient, and omnipotent, that is all-knowing and all-seeing, knew what the outcome would be, which is how we can rectify those two different things, that nothing will change the Lord's mind about where these people are going to go, and the Lord giving them the opportunity to change, because he knew what was going to happen.
Ted?
Yeah, go ahead, Carol.
My answer to the third question is sort of like Richard's. It's three points. First, how all-knowing and powerful God is, how our wisdom pales to God's wisdom, and how easy it is to fool people who don't listen to God.
Yeah, we think we're high and mighty because we can put a rover on the surface of Mars right now. You know, we can program a computer so that it can take care of it and land itself. What we don't understand is God built the solar system. Mm-hmm. God put in place all natural law that we use to do that. God built the universe. And we sometimes forget that God is in control. And if the book of Jeremiah does anything, I think it points out, like Faye said, and like Anne said, God is in control. We need to realize that God is in control every day of our lives. Even though we may not understand what is happening, God is in control. God is in control of our country. And our country, if it continues down its backsliding and downward spiral, will go the same way every other country that has taken that direction. It may take a long time because God is long-suffering and is willing to wait for as many to be saved as possible.
But, and I think, excuse me, Ted.
Go ahead, Carol.
I was going to say, and that's the key. He's wanting as many of us to be back with him as possible. And that's why he's long suffering. And once we get on his bad side, it's too late. I mean, like he gave those people time after time after time chances, and they still, hello. I mean, what part of it didn't you get? But we can be the same way, you know.
Absolutely.
We can be the same way.
If and I tell anything my. We can...
Oh, I'm sorry. I was gonna say, and I tell my family, if you stick with him, he'll stick with you. He doesn't mince words. He doesn't lie. He means what he says.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, a lesson we can take from this is the Lord's message is not convoluted. Mm-mm. It's not hard to understand. And it's something, if we choose to live our lives based on what the Lord has told us to do, we'll have a better life for it.
Mm-hmm.
But so many people choose not to do that. And to their own detriment. Not only in this life, but the next. So the last question there was, what lesson sticks out the most of all that you learned from the study of this book? Summarizing the book is one thing. These lessons that you can take from Jeremiah, and many of you have pointed out these ideas, but the lessons that sticks out the most from Jeremiah, what lesson sticks with you the most from our study over these 23 weeks?
To do what he says he's going to do.
I think if there's anything we can learn from what we've studied is that the Lord follows through on his word. We have been told what was going to happen. Let me rephrase that. The Israelites were told what was going to happen if they betrayed the covenant. And at the time, six tribes shouted the blessings and six tribes shouted the curses. They all knew what was going to happen. They should have been teaching their children what was going to happen. That should have been handed down from generation to generation as people learned and were taught about God. But the people strayed away from God. God's people turned their backs on him, turned towards stone, wood, metal, towards the natural heavenly bodies, worshiping the things that the Creator had created. Instead of giving God his glory for being the Creator, they bowed down to the creation. And so I think if we can, for me, the lesson that sticks out the most is, as was pointed out here, stick with God and he'll stick with you. That brings our study to a close, unless anybody has anything else they wanted to add to these last couple of statements. I don't have anything else to add myself. I think I've said my piece about Jeremiah. I do want to thank everybody who participated in our classes as we were going on over these last 5 months. And I also want to put a shout out towards, let me take a look at my, I'm going to end my slideshow here. Hold on just a second. I got to look at where I got most of my material from. It was from a Church of Christ in California that I got a lot of my material from, and just an excellent outline I got from their website that gave me a lot of the ideas and the material that I used for you guys. Looks like it was a study that they did back in the early 2010s, 2011, something like that. But I'd like to say thank you so much for the material that I was able to utilize for the questions and outlines, and helped me a whole lot for my studies and for all that they did to help us have a great class. It was just amazing to Rose Avenue Church of Christ is what it was in California. So shout out to them for all the help that they gave me, even if they don't know they did. And then thanks to all of you for being part of the class.